Well, we have gathered again. God bless you for being here. Again, as I mentioned, we're going to do something. We're switching gears. Not switching gears unintentionally. We've come to the point where we need to switch gears. I would submit to you, and actually, I don't think I will get much disagreement from this august group, that...
I don't know that word.
August means magisterial. Magisterial. Yeah.
That's,
that the United States was a different place before the Civil War and after the Civil War, a significantly different place in a lot of different ways. We're still the same states and so forth, but a different view about the world. I mean, ostensibly, prior to that, there was an undercurrent of this is a group of many nations that have an affinity for one another, and because of which... they will get together and do stuff together to a truly federal government. Also, a perspective of leadership. Prior to the Civil War, the leadership, the best description would be Lee and Grant. Lee is definitely an emblem of aristocracy. I mean, you might as well be in England, for crying out loud, with a guy like Lee and his pedigree, and with a guy like Grant. Grant's one of my... I'm a Virginian, and this is going to sound strange, but I am a big fan of Ulysses S. Grant. I find him to be a fascinating historical character, and the switch that takes place is fascinating here because you have a storekeeper. On the one hand, you have a man born to the manor who was destined for greatness and went to the academy for all manner of things and everything that went with him, the picture of gentility and a storekeeper. And yet these two men sort of exemplify what America was before the Civil War and America would become after the Civil War. This decided move towards the Midwest and away from the Southern leadership that so dominated the first decades of the United States. America was still America, still a land of opportunity, still all that, but a different perspective. I would submit to you, and there's, you may have to think about this a little bit, that America was a different place prior to World War II and immediately after World War II. America prior to World War II was ostensibly rural. And I don't care where you're from. I know that the epicenter of the rural culture of America truly is the upper Midwest, and to a large degree still is, but it was everywhere that the rural nature of America was the case. After World War II, America is still the same country, but it's decidedly suburban. We don't live in a city, let's be honest. We live in this area right here, and the area around Rose Creek is a suburb. I mean, it looks like any place that you could go in America. There, and I know that people get a little offended, and I don't care where I've said this. People get offended. They try to think of their... But you can go down 52nd, and I can take the stores on 52nd and find them in Dayton, Ohio, in Frisco, Texas, and anywhere else. There is this homogeneity of suburbia that has become America, and that's largely after World War II. I would also submit to you, and this is going to be a little bit closer to home here, and most of us might have the memories of this, that America was a different place prior to Vietnam than it is today. That after the before the Vietnam War, America was one way, a very sort of, I don't hesitate to use the word pride, had a lot of pride in the country, a lot of positive, a lot of trust of the government, a lot of trust of our elected officials, a lot of trust of our establishment, a lot of trust of a lot of things, or organizations. And after Vietnam, a profound distrust of those same institutions. America was a different place before Vietnam than after Vietnam. Still America, though. Still America. And the reason why I bring this up is because in the Bible, in the Old Testament in particular, well, let's specifically talk about the Old Testament because that's what we're talking about. In the Old Testament, something significant happens that changes everything about how Israel understands itself. And that significant thing is the exile into Babylon and the subsequent return of Israel to the land of Judea, I guess you'd call it that, Judea after the exile. Things have changed. And nowhere do we see this more than the next set of books that we're getting ready to study. We're not done with the Minor Prophets yet, but there's a big difference between the first nine books and the last three. There's a very big difference. But I want to give you kind of an overview, a cultural overview about those three, plus all the other books that are considered to be what people call post-exilic or after the exile. Because there are several parts of the Old Testament there are. And just to kind of give you an idea of which ones we're talking about, the books of Haggai, the books of Zechariah, and the books of Malachi are all post-exilic. They were written and took place after the exile. Okay? The books of 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles, which in fact is just one book in the Hebrew, it's just one book, that is was clearly written after the exile. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which again, in our Bible is two books, but in the Hebrew Bible is one book, that was clearly written after the exile. And the events there talked about it as well have to do with the exile, or the post-exile. And this is a touchy one. We're going to handle this book differently altogether. We're going to, when we get to it, because there are some people who suggest that it's a pre-exilic book, or actually an exilic book, a book that takes place during the exile, and there's some that suggest that it's actually the most recent book written, and that's the book of Daniel. As far as when the books of the Old Testament were written, there's none more controversial than the book of Daniel. And I'm going to have a whole special session on Daniel and all that it means in how it relates to the New Testament. Robert, yes?
Why does it bring such controversy?
Well, wow, great question. Without wading into it too deeply, the book of Daniel, well, it depends upon what glasses you have. If you have a pair of glasses that are open to God being a supernatural God, I mean, what kind of God would you want? I mean, would you really not want a supernatural God? I mean, think about that. But the chapter 11 of Daniel provides an amazingly accurate description of the post-Alexandrine, pardon me for using that word, Alexandrine, I mean after Alexander the Great, it provides an incredible description of the world in that part of what's going on, that little part of the world there, with incredible precision about the various kings that come up and so forth. The precision is such that critical scholars have suggested it could have only taken place as somebody sort of pretending to look back and nostalgically try to understand the events of their current time sort of through the lens of this very famous person of many centuries earlier. Okay, that's the critical perspective. There's a number of books like that, like the book of Isaiah. Some suggest that chapters 40 through 66 were also post-exilic. I'm not one of those people, but there are people who do, for the same sort of reasons. The same sort of reasons. For example, in Isaiah 45, the name Cyrus is mentioned. Okay? Well, think about that. I mean, I'm not suggesting that God is not capable of the supernaturally telling the prophet that there's going to be a guy named Cyrus. But if you don't believe in supernatural prophecy, and you're just coming across the book, you say, wait a minute, if Isaiah is supposed to be living in, say, the 7th century B.C., and Cyrus is from the 5th century B.C., we got an issue. So it's stuff like that. Okay. But Daniel, we're going to deal with Daniel differently. Let's not go in the weeds on that. There's something I want to get to about this other stuff. It's that reflection, because we all have reflected. I mean, any of us who lived on one side of Vietnam and have lived on the other side of Vietnam, reflect on that. Reflect on the America that was and the America that is. We think about that. Well, there's something going on here very similar to that in the Old Testament that colors what comes next, that sort of wondering about things. But let's kind of work through this a little bit. First of all, let me give you kind of a brief timeline that we're talking about here. In 586 or 587 B.C., the Babylonians finally come through for God. I know that sounds funny, but basically God has been, we have been waiting through all this prophetic literature saying, you know, if you don't straighten up and fly right, bad stuff's going to happen. Well, the Babylonians come and provide the bad stuff. In 721 BC, the Assyrians provided the bad stuff for the northern kingdom and pretty much assimilated them. They were, if you'll pardon the Star Trekism, they were the Borg of the ancient Near East. You know, resistance is futile. You will be assimilated. So for those, that was 200 years earlier, correct. 721-22 versus 586-87. Okay, so most everybody, not everybody, but most everybody is carted off into exile. All the educated people, all the royal people, all the people with good jobs, all that sort of stuff, all the people with potential are carted off into Babylon. All right? All your above, all basically all the students from Lake Wobegon High School, because they're above average, all right? You know, so all of them have been carted off. Okay? The Babylonians are putting these people to work by running the country for them, because they find that these people are good administrators, and that's what they're doing. They're putting them to work. Well, the Persians, who are a completely different ethnic group of people, completely different cultural group of people, they come through, and shortly after, well, somewhere in the 530s to 520s, I have to work backwards here, they ostensibly come through and clean the clocks of the Babylonians. And then they show up and they find all these people here that are from Judah and Benjamin and the Judean provinces, And they say, what are you all doing here? He said, well, we were carted off into captivity in order to be all the civil servants and do all the work that the Babylonians didn't want to do. So that's what happens. And they say, well, that's a dumb idea. You can't make money for us that way. I got a better way for you to make money. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to go back home. Go back home to where you'll be happy and pay taxes and serve our Persian emperor, and things will be great. You will become one of 127 provinces that stretch from basically the Mediterranean to the Ganges River. That's a big piece of real estate, just to let you know. That would include all of the Middle East, much of Turkey, part of Egypt, then moving forward to all of modern-day Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and maybe a little smidgen sliver of India. 127 provinces that they had control over. Persians. Modern, what would be ethnically and culturally modern-day Iran, okay? All right. Not Arabs.
No.
Be real clear about that. They are Persians, okay? So their idea is to do things on a big scale, but the only way to do things on a big scale is you've got to get people to do things that you want them to do where they're at. It's the division of labor. They figured it out. The Babylonians basically couldn't do it that way, but the Persians had figured it out. So the Persians send them back. And they go back in a couple groups, and we see this first in Ezra, and then we see it in Nehemiah. Ezra? Nebuchadnezzar is the guy that takes them. Cyrus is the guy that lets them go back, and another guy by the name of Xerxes, or in some Bibles it's Artaxerxes, okay? But Xerxes, Cyrus, they're the Persian guys that say, all y'all go back home. Well, I hope that I don't ever find myself in any kind of bondage or any kind of jail sentence or anything like that. But one of the things that's my understanding happens is that you have time to think about stuff and you have time to reflect. And part of the time that you have to reflect is, how did we get ourselves in this predicament? All right, if we believe in a God that is basically the creator of the universe, and that all these other gods are pagan gods and truly idols and just nothing but wood and metal and stone, how do we get ourselves into this mess? And so you have a lot of self-reflection that goes on in this time period. And one of the things that they think about is, well, let's consider what we might have done wrong. So you have four books. Well, we have four books, but there are actually only two, and maybe there were really only one, and that is the books of Chronicles and Ezra, Nehemiah. If you read through the books of Chronicles, you'll say to yourself, wow, this looks suspiciously like 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. Kind of. You've got the same players, but you've got a lot of other things that aren't quite the same. What you have in 1 and 2 Chronicles that you don't have in 1 and 2 Kings is an absolutely obsessive interest in the temple and an absolutely obsessive interest in the Levitical priesthood that's not present in the books of Samuel and Kings. You see stuff there that is, as I said, those seem to be the two driving themes of those books. You see Ezra. They come back, and what do they do when they come back? They build a temple because the other one's been flattened. Now, if you'll pardon the phrase, they build a pretty crappy temple because there are a few people, old-timers, who see this thing and say, well, they would have put it differently, but they say, that's a pretty crappy temple. This thing doesn't look anything like the old one. This is pretty awful. It really, and they're sad because it doesn't look, but, you know, they build it anyway. And that's really the sort of the outline of what's going on, because we need to reinstitute that temple worship. Number two in Nehemiah is that somehow there are people out there that are not all that keen on the temple being rebuilt, or the tribes of Judah and Benjamin coming back, and the Levites coming back. And so they figured, well, we need to protect ourselves. And so they build a wall, or rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. And that's the book of Nehemiah.
So that's not topical at all.
No, this is not topical. Yeah, exactly. What would that have anything to do with today, for crying out loud? I mean, pity's sake. I suspect that it doesn't cost whatever this thing costs. But yes, Robert.
So if the temple wasn't up to standard and they're building a wall, is the wall up to standard, and what were their resources? How could they build a fantastic temple if they didn't have resources? And this is the Persian Empire?
Okay, great.
They don't want to control this area?
Well, basically, all their interest is okay, back to the geography of the area. They want access to the breadbasket. They want control of the breadbasket, which is the Nile River. Remember the Nile River? That's the one that's got all the food. That's kind of what they want. And you got to remember that the Persians are the people that are in charge. They're running the show. The exiles return to the provinces of Judea and Benjamin as servants of their Persian overlords. Yeah, they're not in charge. They are merely servants of their Persian overlords. Okay, so they kind of reflect back on what's going on in that time. So the book of Chronicles sort of says we need to start thinking about, you know, what went wrong there. Now, the other curious thing about the book of Chronicles is this, and when we get to Chronicles, we'll touch on this, is that you don't see anything of the kings of the north. There's no mention of them. I mean, well, I shouldn't say no. There's such insignificant mention of them, it isn't funny. But the kings of the south, you see them. And the other thing you don't see a lot of is you don't see a lot of rotten things said about David. I mean, that's one of the great things about, you know, 1 and 2 Samuel, is that you see David, warts and all. I mean, you wouldn't know about David, warts and all, if you were just reading Chronicles. It's sort of been sanitized, if I dare say that. It just says this is kind of how it is, and this is what we need to be doing. We have a couple of big themes that come up. Theme number one: the importance of getting it right. We got it wrong the last time, so therefore we need to obsess about getting it right. Okay, that's theme number one, and you see that in these particular books. And then theme number two, you see the importance of David as being the ideal king. David was the ideal king, and if we could only get a king like David, life would be good again. If we'd only get a king like David, life would be fantastic and all our worries would be over with. Forgetting some of the things that we'd already seen about David. So it kind of reminds us of, I mean, someone who was a little bit less kind to the inspiration of Scripture might say it's revisionist history. Nevertheless.
The First Chronicles, they talk in lovingly about David and King and what a great thing instead of
You're not going to find the rotten stuff about David and so forth in there. No, you will find the rotten stuff in there about some of the other kings, but not David. Yeah. Also, but again, the importance of the whole idea of the Levitical priesthood. This is huge now. Whereas before in the old history, this wasn't such a big deal. I mean, it was there, but now it's huge.
Is part of that because now they don't have their own king?
Well, that's certainly a big part of it, for sure. That's good. Going back to the David thing, they don't have their own king, which is going to get to, sashay into the other remaining post-exilic books in a second. That's a good point. We'll come back to that. Okay. So that's a big feature of this. So they're trying to look it through the lens of, this is what the ideal should be. All right. Previously, the prophets were, basically saying, you guys need to repent because we got serious problems, versus this is how if we only could achieve the ideal, life would be grand. Life would be grand.
Priests were like the works righteousness. That's why the law bring us back to the...
They had rules to follow.
Well, they certainly had no shortage of rules to follow. There's no question about that. And there are some people, again, the critical scholars suggest that much of those Levitical rules that we see in Leviticus and Numbers actually came from this time period. I'm not a big fan of that particular perspective, but I throw it out there because the kids that you so lovingly sent off to GLCs heard that, or were taught that, I should say that.
I'm just wondering
why would you send your kids to a GLC? I'm sorry. So you know what GLC is? Good Lutheran College.
And you'd send your kid to a GLC because you didn't want to send him to a BLC.
A BLC? Bad Lutheran College?
So if I'm getting the feel for this,
yes.
When we move along to Jesus and then he sees what's happened.
Yes.
Basically, people are following rules, but their heart's not right about why they're following.
Which is, in fact... The point I've been trying, you're getting to the point where I'm trying to get to. That we have to understand how we went from this to this. This is, we'll get to a second. This is Moses through the end of the prophets, except for these three that I'll get to. And then this is the stuff that's after. How do we get there? Okay, yes.
You mentioned people looking back and reflecting. Are they trying to regain God's favor?
Well, of course. Yeah, they wonder. Yeah, exactly. How did all this happen? Again, you will recall from the other account of the period of history says a tent was just fine. If you want to build a temple, knock yourself out. But a tent is just fine for me. You don't see that same conversation in Chronicles. It's not there. So you have that. So that's a very good observation. So that's kind of what's going on in Chronicles and Ezra and Nehemiah. Another thing that's going on with Ezra is that you have a guy who's writing all this stuff down. You start to see, here's the guy that's been sort of bringing all these things together in a codified manner. Now, we got Ezra, Nehemiah, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Just to let you know, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, the one book, is in fact the last book of the Hebrew Bible. We'll talk about that sometime in May. Okay? Now, let's deal with these other three books here, these prophetic books, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Haggai is probably the least known, but Haggai presents an interesting perspective, and we're going to look at that next week. Haggai presents perspective, sort of a prophet's perspective of rebuilding the temple. A prophet's perspective of rebuilding the temple. It's an alternate view. I'm not saying it's a conflicting view, but it's an alternate view of the book of Ezra. Prophets prophets do what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to serve as a corrective to the people in power And if the people in power aren't doing the things that they're supposed to be doing, well, guess what? That's what the prophet does. The prophet serves as a corrective to that. And in this particular book, the people are not taking care of the rebuilding of the temple. So we've got that. So Haggai serves in that particular role. The next one is Zechariah. Zechariah is by far the most interesting book of the minor prophets. By far. Zechariah is kind of a prophetic book and the book of Revelation all rolled into one. We're going to have spend a little bit more time on Zechariah when we get to that. Zechariah really is in two parts, chapters 1 through 8 and chapters 9 through 12. In addition to, well, here's the thing about Zechariah. Okay, now that you're here or back home again, one of the most conspicuous things missing, okay, you got your temple, you got your priesthood, you got your homes. What's missing? You don't have a king. This is a hugely messianic book, Zechariah. Incredibly, it's both apocalyptic in the sense of it has a lot of visions about how sort of the end of time and so forth, but also the ushering in of the Messianic age. And so you get this flavor of the book that Zechariah comes across, lots of great stuff in there, and also some very very New Testament themes that you're going to see. Palm Sunday. What happens on Palm Sunday?
King comes riding on a donkey.
King comes riding in on a donkey. Well, where does that come from? Well, it comes from Zechariah. That's where that comes from. So you've got the king coming in riding on a donkey. And so you have that feature of the book of Zechariah. There are other things in there that we'll take a closer look at. And then last but not least, you have Malachi, the Italian prophet. Oh, I'm sorry, that's Malachi, if I dare still allowed to say such things like that, but I was channeling my inner Norwegian there, John, I'm sorry. I don't have an inner Norwegian, I'm sorry, I forgot about that. So, Malachi is a curious book, alleged to be the last book written of the Old Testament. This book, probably somewhere around 440 to 400 BC, okay? So it's considerably after they've been back there for a while, okay? They came back somewhere between 530 and 515 and then came back in cycles. So that's almost 120 years. What you have is a ringing chastisement and rebuke of the priesthood. It is absolutely resounding, and it's almost very prophetic, and it's almost like, oh my, here we go again. Here we go again. This is not going to be good. This is going to be epically bad, and as such, we're going to have some pretty serious problems. Okay. It ends with a rather ominous statement, you know, that God will return and send the prophet, send Elijah the prophet, lest he come and turn the hearts of the sons to the fathers, lest I come and smite the land with a curse.
That's Malachi?
That's Malachi, chapter 4. Fact check me there? Go right ahead. Why don't you read it?
So that's not a very good way to end the story.
Right? Oh, it's a horrible way to end the story. I mean, it's a terrible... Well, this is exactly the point. That it doesn't matter whether you end the story with 2 Chronicles chapter 36 or Malachi 4. They're terrible, terrible ways to end the story. I mean, if you're telling a story, this is not how you want the book to end. Okay? You really don't. There's obviously... some unfinished business. You have people, number one, putting their faith in religion rather than the relationship that is so wonderfully expressed throughout the books of Moses, the books of Samuel and Kings, all the prophets. I mean, it's about relationship. What you have is you have people setting up this almost system of religion that's being set up. And still looking for God. I mean, can't fault them for not looking for God, but you do see this system that's sort of being installed there. So you have that that's there. But also at the same time, you see this messianic hope arising. You see this hope for something better that's going to come, and you see God telling his people that this is what he wants to have happen. Because in each of them, of course, the Zechariah is a book that speaks of the coming of the Messiah, whereas Malachi is a book that speaks of the coming of the forerunner of the Messiah. Kind of interesting. This whole quandary about what do you do about Elijah? That's kind of how it ends. Well, we're in a quandary. We have some unfinished business. Elijah has not come back yet. The Messiah hasn't come yet. And so what are we going to do? And these are some of the questions that these books present us. And with the end of Malachi, an unfortunate phraseology has arisen within Protestantism. What comes next, some people describe as the 400 silent years. Well, at the end of all this, we're going to discuss that second period, because remember I said how there are various periods in American history where the things weren't the same as they were before. Well, the same is true here. Here we have one of those periods where things change, but this 400-year period between the time of Malachi and the coming of Christ is A, anything but silent, and B, exceedingly important to understand in light of what came before it, this period of the post-exile, and the period that comes after it, and what's going on during that time. But that's for another day. So, are there any questions or observations here before we dive into all this? Yes.
During that time of exile, who was in Judea? There were leftovers.
The leftovers, yes. Were
people able to come back to those areas?
Yes.
Had there other tribes when that moved in?
You know, this is an interesting question. What does in fact happen to the northern tribes? Because in the Christmas story, you have a woman named Anna, correct? Anna's an 84-year-old woman who's a prophetess, who is supposedly of the tribe of Asher. Well, Asher's one of the northern tribes. How does she trace her ancestry? So obviously, some people are left behind, okay? Some people get left behind. There is what you might call a remnant that's left behind of the northern tribes, okay? Then you have others who are from the southern tribes who are a remnant. There's probably a little more of them that are left behind, but you also have a lot of other people, interlopers, people coming in from Edom. The Edomites are the shirt-tail relatives of the people of Israel, and constant nemesis. I mean, they're at each other constantly, and they're kind of hanging out there. Then you also have the rise of, in this time period, of Arabs. We have not mentioned Arabs much at all, also called Nabataeans. They've not been mentioned a lot. They tended to be Bedouins, tended to be people that lived in a very nomadic lifestyle, but they come to the fore in these particular books. the old saying, nature abhors a vacuum. You know, here, if I'm going to take all these people who are living at this particular level and move them to Babylon, well, people living at the lower level are going to say, hey, look at all these cool homes that got left behind. I think I'm going to go move in there. And you even have this guy, Sanballat, who's kind of one of my favorite names of all the enemies of Israel. Just the name Sanballat sounds like a great name. But nevertheless, nobody names their kid Sanballat. I mean, please don't. Sanballat and Tobiah decide to take up residence in the temple even. So, yes, Ernie.
Do you think that during this time that a lot of the lost tribes of Israel became a realization?
Well, again, let's talk briefly about the whole issue of the, quote, lost tribes of Israel. This is wishful thinking, largely, on the part of a lot of aberrant groups. Uh-huh. There is this theory of... There is many lost tribe theories, as you can think of, sort of quasi-Jewish or quasi-Christian cults running around out there. There are all sorts of theories about the lost tribes of Israel. I suppose one could track this down genetically, but really what happens is that they don't get lost. They just, again, as if you'll pardon the...
No, they get similar.
They get assimilated. Yeah. They get, which is, again, how the Assyrians did business. They took you from here and put you there. They took you from here and put you there. And they took the guys from there and put them here. And that's what they did. And if you look at, I believe it's 2 Kings 17, you see this in action. That's what they're doing. You see them doing this. But
how did they get over in China?
How did they get over in China? You know, when I get the time, I'm going to study this more carefully, but the migrations of human populations is stunning. Why is it that in... This is a brief rabbit trail. This is, has nothing to do with anything important. But there is a genetic marker in the DNA of certain Jewish people living today called Kohanism. Kohen is the word for priest. And this genetic marker was allegedly for those people who were of the tribe of Levi. And again, it's my understanding that this genetic marker can be identified in people living today, which is fine. Except for you find the same genetic marker in a rather curious group of people who live in southern Africa, who are clearly African people, I mean, ethnically African people, and that they're monotheistic when the Portuguese and Spanish got there to show up, and that the same group of people have this Kohen marker in them. I don't know.
But they're practicing Jews?
Well, you know, they say they are.
Yeah.
And they say they have been for a long time. You have people living in China that are practicing Jews.
Right.
And they look as Chinese as anybody else that looks Chinese. I mean, that looks Chinese. I mean, yeah, I don't know, Ernie. That's a great question. Yeah. I guess it chose to go you that... it chose to go you. But in any case, back to where was I? It was a rabbit trail.
And
what about the northern tribe? Yes. Okay. There's probably a handful of them hanging around. Who else is there? Well, you have this steady stream of people who have their union card, so to speak. They can prove their genealogy. You know, that's a big deal. And let me show you a reason why it's a big deal. Turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 1. Now, if you have problems sleeping at night, You know, people always pick on Leviticus. What's it got? What do you got there?
Lots of names.
Oh, and it keeps going until chapter 10. It keeps going until chapter 10 because the ability to trace your genealogy back is important. Now, if you go through there, another thing you're going to find is interesting is a disproportionate amount of ink spilled on Levites and how important that is. Okay, you'll find that as well. So again, this is that thing. But yeah, it goes on and on and on with regard to these. Now, every now and then, you'll find something curious in there. And though somebody made a huge book, it wasn't a huge book, it was a tiny little book, but they sold 6 million of them from just something wedged in these genealogies. Do you remember? The prayer of Jabez, for crying out loud. Goodness gracious sakes alive. Wouldn't you like to have the royalties for that? Well, you know, what happened was this. I mean, I think the prayer of Jabez is a very interesting prayer. It's in 4. Yeah.
1 Chronicles 4.
Well, Linda, do you have the verses there on it by any chance?
It's on 9, 4 verse 9.
4 verse 9. You want to read that, Linda? Yeah. Don't we want to read that?
Jabez was more honorable than his brothers, and his mother called his name Jabez, saying, "Because I bore him in pain." Jabez called upon the God of Israel, saying, "Oh, that you would bless me and enlarge my border, and that your hand might be with me, and that you would keep me from harm so that it might not bring me pain." God granted what he asked.
Now, this is a significant piece of scripture for the following reason. Anytime you see an aberration of any kind in a genealogy, you should pay attention and say, what's going on here? If it goes from so-and-so begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so, and then all of a sudden a woman's name shows up, you should ask, why did a woman's name show up? Because there weren't a lot of women's names in these genealogies. You should ask that. Or so-and-so begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so, and then all of a sudden it goes off into a branch of brothers. You guys, why are we doing that now? But if there's a little story that goes with it, you got to ask yourself, what's this little story all about? And so the author, David Wilkerson, is that the name?
Yeah.
I think that's it. Wilkerson? He was a, pardon? Yeah, who is that? Bruce Wilkerson, David Wilkerson, across the switchblade. Yes, I got my wrong people there mixed up. Yes, Bruce. He was a going item at Dallas Theological Seminary. That's it. And Howard Hendricks was his mentor, and Howard Hendricks inspired him to write this. I think that was the way. I could be wrong about all of that. So in any case, but the prayer Jabez, it's a significant spiritual sort of thing, and he kind of glommed on to this, and it got traction. Yeah. So, you know, but there's only so many of those things that you're going to find in there. So.
In all those names, there's no Bob.
There's no Bob. You know, Robert, and you know, you don't get to a Paul until the New Testament. That's kind of a ripoff, too, you know. There's no Bob. Oh, that's great. Yeah, you know, there's not.
You'd be a little hesitant to ask somebody, well, where did you come from?
Yeah.
It could be a long conversation.
It could be a very long. But the idea was these genealogies were to show that I've got pedigree. Now, why do you want pedigree? To show that you're kind of a little bit more special than anybody else. So there's a lot of things that are going on here that indicate a change in the whole cultural thing, the landscape that's going on. But not just cultural, but the spiritual landscape that's going on. And God sends the prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, to deal with the same thing. Previously, the prophets were sort of the thorn in the side of the king, right? The king thought he was all that, and the prophets were there to remind him that he was not all that, and that he needed to submit himself to the true king, who is the Lord, which we already saw in 1 Samuel chapter 8. So now the prophets are having to say, well, listen, you know, we need to not make the same mistake twice. And you see them doing that, making the same mistake twice, particularly as time transpires, particularly when you get to the book of Malachi, which we'll get to shortly, I mean, not within the next couple weeks. So,
about 400 years, is that struggle to get things right? Because in the third chapter of Malachi, the Lord, capital L-O-R-D,
sure,
says, "Return to me, and I will return to you," says the Almighty.
Yes.
The Lord Almighty. And then, as you said, the last verses of Malachi, you'll send the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes.
Yes. Yeah. So, we got to figure all this out. Now, what's going on in that 400 years? You got to say something for the end. You got to say something for May. You got to let me, you know, have that. That's actually, you don't want to miss that one. That's going to be a good time when we talk about those 400 years, because I personally find you can't understand the New Testament without understanding those 400 years and how we got from here to there. Okay, that's real important, very important. But we're not there yet. Okay. But yes, we have problems already. Part of the problems are, again, a very ossifying, very sort of stricture upon what God's people are doing. You don't have rank idolatry. That you don't have. That was the problem before. The big problem now, and I guess my opinion, is religiosity, which I guess is a form of idolatry. I mean, I guess you could say that, but there is this form that religiosity is becoming the big problem that they have to deal with.
So it seems to me, you're coming out of exile.
Yep.
That they haven't been trained in the old ways necessarily. Mm-hmm. So the Levites come, and they're the ones who know everything, and they've got all the rules, and they're kind of pushing that. The people have a longing for God, just don't know how to find Him. And I would relate it to, in a little, it's probably a broad stroke here, but relate it a little bit to people today that have a longing for God, and whether they follow televangelists or whether they go off on some Eastern mysticism or whatever, they're searching, but ultimately following the wrong path.
Well, there is some wrong path following going on here. There's no question of that. Yeah, and it's typical of human behavior. It is very typical of human behavior, and of course, we don't have the whole story yet. The whole story is going to unfold, and we're getting closer to the New Testament, and we're getting closer to that time, but we don't have the whole story yet, and I think it's important for us to see that. Again, some of the positive things to come out of this, though, do have to do with the sense of, okay, we need to look forward to something that this whole messianic hope, the idea that the coming of Christ, the coming of that, that's probably the best thing to come out of this period, is that this idea that we really need to be looking forward to the Savior God has, well, not Savior, the Messiah, the King.
One of the minor prophets
there? Yes, we're going to get to that yet. Okay. Yeah, we haven't gotten there yet. Zechariah, yes.
God with us, at one point we had the pillar of fire,
yep.
or the pillar of smoke.
Both.
And that. So when did the people lose that visual?
They lost that pretty soon. That only was for 40 years. They only had that for while they were in the wilderness. Yeah.
That was the only time.
And may I add this that you say, I'd believe if only I had a sign. Think about this. Think of the unbelief that happened when they had the most amount of signs. I mean, think about this. They saw the Red Sea part, and they immediately started murmuring. They saw manna in the wilderness, and they started murmuring. Yeah, exactly. We only get 6 days of this, and with the last day we get double. And I mean, time after time after time, in spite of God manifesting himself in the most obvious ways, you could not have a greater faithlessness. I mean, what? You got Joshua and Caleb, and I suppose you could have to say Eleazar and a handful of others. But, I mean, really? So anybody, time someone says to you, you know, if I could only see those signs and wonders, then I would believe. Well, what about all these people who saw the best signs and wonders you could possibly see? And you know what they got to do? They got to die in the wilderness because of their unbelief. Go figure. Yes. So
when these people got released and got to go back to Israel, these were the
Judea.
Yeah. These were the de la creme de la creme.
Well, these were the children of that. Yes.
Yes.
So 70 years.
70 years. Yeah.
So when they returned, did they resume their blood sacrifices and altar?
Well, yes. Sure. Because now you could do that. Because they got a temple. If you got a, you see, you can only do that if you got a temple. Yeah, exactly. It says, yeah, but at least you can do that. Yeah, you know. Now, see, Herod's going to come along. Herod the Great's going to come along at the end of the, quote, silent 400 years. And Herod the Great's going to say, this just won't do, friends. This just will not do. I'm going to fix this. And Herod the Great fixes the temple in a most amazing way, probably more opulent than the Temple of Solomon. We don't know that for a fact, but it's a good likelihood that it was at least as opulent as the Temple of Solomon, or maybe more opulent than the Temple of Solomon.
Great Wall, is that part of
the temple? You mean the Wailing Wall?
Yeah.
Actually, the Wailing Wall is probably a part of the Temple of Solomon.
Oh, okay.
It's probably part of the foundation of Solomon's temple.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because they built it right on top of it. I mean, you know, you have seen those blocks. Has anybody ever, I mean, anybody else been to Israel? We need to do that. Okay, well, this year, let's just decide. Let's just decide we need to go as a group field trip. But to give you, seriously, that'd be a great field trip, don't you think? Let's plan on it. I need someone to be my administrative assistant to get this thing off the ground. But I think it'd be a wonderful thing to do. I would love to do it with y'all. Wouldn't it be fun to go as a field trip?
Absolutely.
Well, just to give you some idea of how big the stone blocks are for the foundation. I don't want to exaggerate. They're not quite as tall as the ceiling. Not quite. But they're from about here to there, and that's how big they are. This is solid stone, and there's lots of them. I mean, holy cow, how did they do that? There is a tunnel that runs alongside the wall, the Western Wall, that... Because today, where the temple would have been, is a mosque. And so Jews can't go in there. You have to be... Okay. Yeah, well, there you go. Oh, I thought it was...
NASCAR.
There you go. But so the closest place you can get to the Holy of Holies and be Jewish is outside this wall, in this tunnel... And there's these little place that people, you go through the tunnel and you run into people there praying because they're at the closest spot to where the Holy of Holies used to be. So that's kind of an interesting little thing there. But we'll do that. So we sign up for that, just plan it. All right. We need about 30 to 40 people to go. 30 to 40 people. No, that would be very few. That would be a lot of empty seats on a bus. A bus can hold 40. Yeah, you don't want any more than 40, though. It's a biblical number. Yeah. pardon? No, I don't want to jinx. That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But that would be. We should probably do that. That would probably be a fitting endeavor. Back to Zechariah. Were we on Zechariah before? The temple. But blood sacrifices. Bob, you set us off on this rabbit trail about blood sacrifices. Yes. They did have them going on then and there, yes. They stopped them when the temple got flattened, which was Herod's temple many, many years later.
Okay. So, obviously, originally the priests had to be Levites.
Well, they still have to be Levites. Yeah, they still.
But how would they necessarily trace their heritage unless, of course, they read Chronicles?
Well, this is the deal. Well, I mean, think about it. Well, again, we, as moderns, we tend to denigrate people that lived in ancient times, and we do so wrongly. They have amazing ways of tracing their lineage, and they could do so orally, and that would be sufficient to do that. And that would have been sufficient for them, too. That would have been enough witness for them to be able to go take it back that way, and that would have been fine for them. So, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is that we can do a genetic test and find out, does somebody have this Cohen marker? And people do. That's the crazy thing. So, oh well.
The Indian tribes now around here too, you can find out your, it's all verbal.
Yeah, and they prefer not the DNA thing. They kind of frown on that. Yeah. Which I'm all bored with them frowning on it. That's okay, you know. They have their oral traditions, which are fine. I got no heartburn with that. Yeah. Yeah. So in any case, back to but Herod kicked it up a notch. Actually, Herod was crazy that way. The guide that I had said that if it weren't for the great oppressor of the Jews and Jesus, who was sort of the great splitter of the Jews, we Jews would be out of business who are travel guides, because people come here to see the works of Herod and the works of Jesus, and that's why they come to visit. He had a sense of humor about it. I thought that was pretty funny, that because Herod was not a Jew. Herod was an Edomite who married someone who was Jewish, going back to this whole issue with the Edomites and the Jews back in this time period. So anyway.
So these religiosity arguments and everything that was going on wasn't just with the Levites. It involved all the tribes, or at least...
Well, Bob, when we get to the 400 silent years, we're going to talk about that. There's a whole different thing going on there. But the real sort of spiritual marker in this is the messianic hope. The hope that there is something coming. And Zechariah really is kind of the jewel of that. When we read through the book of Zechariah, we'll see that whole messianic hope. And apocalypticism and messianic hope kind of go hand in hand. I mean, think of the book of Revelation. What's the consummation of the book of Revelation? A prayer for the coming of Christ, the second coming of Christ. That's what it's about. I mean, it's about and that's what Revelation 21 is about. It's about the consummation of all time in Christ. So there's a strong relationship between those two things.
And that came about in this 400-year period.
Not yet. We were jumping the gun, Bob. We haven't gotten there yet. We haven't gotten
there. I asked that because I understand that in the concept of Judaism, mm-hmm. those who have relinquished Judaism and believe in Christ was the messianic hope.
Yeah.
In other words, the promise that Christ is coming. So their salvation was in Jesus coming, and not...
Having been here. Yeah. Got it. Well, we'll get to that. Judaism really, as we understand Judaism, it doesn't begin until that 400 silent year period. We're not in Judaism yet. We're still in sort of a post-Israelite world. But Judaism, as we understand it today, that develops in that period.
So now we're just talking Israel.
We're talking the remnant of Judah and Benjamin and the Levites.
The
those three tribes, the remnant of Judah, largely, the remnant of the Levites, and the remnant of Benjamin. That's what we're talking about.
In this period
right here, this post-exilic period, yes. Okay. I don't think we have enough time to start Haggai. Got any other questions? Next week.
Next week, Haggai.
And actually, start Haggai and also start Zechariah. Do Haggai and Zechariah chapters 1 through 8. Do those. That's what we'll start looking at specifically in terms of the Bible next week. Okay? I'm sorry to get all this stuff in here, but it helps to know it. It's kind of background. And you know me. I geek out on this stuff. I'm sorry. We kind of skipped Zephaniah. Zephaniah is...
Zephaniah.
The highlight... Okay. Turn to Zephaniah. Turn to Zephaniah 3:17.
What page is that?
What page is... I don't know.
1004.
Yes, and your Faith Partner Study Bible. Zephaniah 3:17. Zephaniah is a synopsis of all the prophets.
Well, there you go. Keep going.
She wants to do this. Zephaniah has the imprecations or the calling down the fire of God on the nations, calling down the fire of God on Judah and the northern tribes. It's got the hope. It's got the judgment. It's got everything. But the best thing about Zephaniah is Zephaniah 3:17. Someone want to read that?
The Lord your God is with you, the mighty warrior who saves. He will take great delight in you. In his love, he will no longer rebuke you, but will rejoice over you with singing.
Yes, indeed. There used to be, back in the day, back when I used to, when I first found out about contemporary Christian music, there was a pretty spiffy praise song that went with this that I particularly liked. And it really does sum up what God's hope for that we could have, that God is in our midst, and it's God who is to save, and he will renew you in his love, and he will rejoice over you with shouts of joy. And there is this sense of joy that comes. And it really, I suppose, would be a fitting end to that first section of prophets. But again, it's kind of ironic because the bottom is going to yet drop out, but this is the promise for things to come in the New Testament. This is God in our midst. That would be clearly a hope for Christ. And the joy that comes from that, and the victory that comes from that, and God's might that comes in all that. So that's really kind of a nice little synopsis. Is that helpful, Rhonda?
Get some of the Day of the Lord judgment stuff.
Geez, I wonder where that comes from.
And all that. And then you say, but yet there's hope.
Yet there is hope, yes. Yeah. Yes, Bob.
How about this theme that kind of goes with Malachi, and that's... Zephaniah 2:3.
What's that say?
Seek the Lord, all you humble of the land.
Yes.
You who dwell in his commands. Seek righteousness, seek humility. Perhaps you will be sheltered on the day of the Lord's anger.
Wow, I like that. That's not a bad deal. That'll preach.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that'll go. That was Zephaniah 2, what?
3.
2:3. That'll go. Yes, indeed. Wow. Bob, why don't you get up here and do it? No. Well, there's Zephaniah. Zephaniah is from the same time as of Habakkuk and Nahum. All right. A little more upbeat than those two guys, but nevertheless, right from that same time period. So, anyway. Any other thoughts, comments? Want to be a part of a historic moment? A being done early in one of my classes? That would be a historic moment. What's that?
I'll put a note.
Historic moment. Pastor Cross was actually done early. How did that happen?
Ran out of things to say.
Well, about this. I've certainly not run out of things to say. I mean, what would you like to talk about? I mean, we can talk about all sorts of things. We can, yeah, absolutely. We could go on and on. I mean, you know, as I've said many times, there's the 12-step group for people who talk too much. On and on and on. Yes.
What is the meaning of the prayer of Jabez? I mean, you know, I know there's hidden, like, rather than what it's been taken off as. I mean, why is that in there?
Why is that in there? I think it's in there for spiritual instruction. I mean, as I said, I think that there is a purpose of that being in there to be instructive of having faith, trusting God, expecting increase. I think that. In the time that it was written, people needed to expect increase. I mean, here you are kind of, you know, you sort of dragging your heels back to this place and you're not seeing things as you'd like them to see. You would need the hope of some increase, the hope of something to go. And I do believe that's one of the things that's important for us as Christian people to understand that God is a God of abundance and God is a God of increase. And, we don't always think that way. I mean, we really don't. I mean, we tend to think that God is a God of scarcity, or we act like God is a God of scarcity. I mean, that is one of the most classic reactions of stewardship campaigns and year-end budgeting processes that you can possibly imagine, that God is a God of scarcity. Well, that's just a lie, number one. God is a God of abundance. God's a God of increase. We have a scarcity mentality oftentimes, but God is the one that has increase. And that's really kind of what it's, the whole idea of enlarging his borders and so forth, that can be seen as prophetic as well, to make this a bigger deal, to include more people. Okay.
You made a comment about pedigree.
Yes.
In terms of all the names.
Yes.
But wouldn't any of the people, the chosen people, be able or have insight into their lineage? And where would the prestige come in, because they were all chosen people?
Only if you can prove it. Here, the thing is, if you read through Ezra and Nehemiah, you'll find out that they're people who couldn't prove their lineage. Now, also, please remember something else, because we say, well, what about this line, or what about this line? The Bible contains true truth, not exhaustive truth, okay? Not every conceivable record about the history of Israel and all the Israelites could be contained in this book. John's Gospel says the exact same thing, that if everything written about Jesus were written down, the world couldn't contain all the books that were written. You know, it's at the end of John's Gospel. So Francis Schaeffer said that the Bible contains true truth, not exhaustive truth. And sometimes we want exhaustive truth. We want all the details that go with it. We just don't have it. What we have is true, but not everything that's true. So I don't know if that's helpful, Bob, or not, but yeah. Okay. Thank you, Bonnie. God bless you. We are going to pray us out of here. These people are baiting me into ruining this historic day. Yes. Father, thank you so much for your word, and thank you for the hope that we have. Thank you that you are, as Zephaniah said, in our midst, that you are a God who saves. You are a God who renews us with your love. You are a God who will rejoice over us. And we give you thanks for all those things, and we will have shouts of joy. Thank you for your word. And send us out in the hope of your word tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.